was born in 1941, and my father and mother had a small grocery store down the pier in Sydney, and when the war started, they converted it to a ship chandlery. So in other words, the convoys that were assembling in Sydney, I believe there were two ship chandleries before World War II, and then I think there were 14 or something like that during the war, and then there were two again. Anyway, so yeah, my father became a ship chandler, and my mother worked in the office as well. And I believe they had moved to Sydney proper, but moved back down. It was so busy because of the convoys that would assemble in Sydney were the slow convoys, so they would be the ones that got picked off easier by the U-boats. And I remember coming across telegrams to my dad that Captain so-and-so, who he had had dinner with, you know, they'd had for dinner a week before, had been torpedoed, you know, off the coast and that kind of thing. So it was, in hindsight, what was to a young couple, you know, with five children, to go through that and be Jewish and to, you know, have the trauma of the Holocaust after, I think, must have been earth-shattering, I think, for many of our parents or, you know, of that era. And they never really talked about it much, but I think that, you know, it was, and the other thing was, because they were dealing with captains and officers from all over the world, we kind of grew up in a house that was like the United Nations, you know, where people would be from all over the world, and that was kind of our upbringing too. That was pretty unusual. And later on, I worked in the business for, well, during the summers, and then for a couple of years after high school, and then during summers when I was in university. So I did a lot of that business myself. And that was an interesting upbringing. In terms of the Jewish community, it was flourishing then because the steel plant was still operating and the coal mines. So as I think I mentioned to you before, there were four synagogues in Cape Breton, two in Sydney, and one in New Waterford, one in Glace Bay. The city proper was built in a kind of horseshoe around the steel plant, which is a huge park and industrial site now. It's been cleaned up, but the steel plant is closed, and all the coal mines in Cape Breton have closed in the last 10, 20 years. So it's an elderly population, extremely elderly now, because not only did many of the kids leave along, you know, for the last 20 or 30, 40 years, but when they got married and started having children, many of the middle-aged and elderly people wanted to be around their grandchildren. So not only did the kids leave, but many of the people left to follow their grandchildren, you know. And so the decline has been rapid and very noticeable over the years, as has been the general population of Cape Breton Island. I was involved with a musical show for 12 years, the Cape Breton Summertime Review, as a music director. And I used to be in the projection booth at the back of the Savoy in Glace Bay and dealing with the sound man or the light man. And over the years, I started to notice how gray the hair was getting and you know, looking at 500 people on the lower lower side of the Savoy Theater. And it just... it increased. We've got a declining population here in general, and so it's affected other churches as well. I think there are, you know, two or three of the four or five Catholic churches in Sydney are closing soon. But my family mostly stayed here. My sister, Sylvia, who passed away a few years ago, was the main choir director after Rabbi Kenner retired. I can't even think of when that was, but he was the rabbi here for 35 years, and wasn't musically trained himself, but became very interested. He was interested in opera, and then trained himself, and along with my sister Sylvia, who was a music, and ended up being a music teacher, as did my sister Evie. She, I believe, helped him to learn to read music, and he assembled really substantial stuff from all over the place, and created a really substantial choir, and which eventually led to the creation of even a woman's choir. My sister Sylvia and I went in. She was 10 and I was 9, and my cousin Jerry Dubinsky, and she was probably the first female to ever be on the bima with the choir, but looked like a boy. There are pictures in the synagogue downstairs in the basement that of those days. So let's see, that must have been 60 odd years ago, and it was really a substantial choir with very intricate, sophisticated harmonies and descants, etc., and timing things. And if it had been in existence now, it would undoubtedly be recording, etc., because it was that good. There were talks of touring New England and things like that. And a lot of people went through it, even from my family of the four surviving children. Two of them are music teachers, and I became a songwriter. So that's a fairly substantial input. And variety of people went on to other aspects of music, but our family kind of became of the senior choir of the of the main choir. At a certain point, I realized that half the choir was my family: my Uncle Harry, my Aunt Shirley, my Aunt Fanny, my cousin Jerry, my cousin Heaney, and along with Sylvia and Evie and Leslie and myself, etc., and my father, my mother. So it was the current rabbi, the traveling rabbi, Rabbi Ellis, who comes in, calls it the Dubinsky Choir. Now, there are really only four or five of us left. We lost a few in the last few years. So what else can I tell you, Eli, besides that stuff?
Well, first of all, thank you. That was incredibly comprehensive, marvelous. Exactly what I'm interested in. Yeah. I was wondering if you could tell me. I've heard so much about Rabbi Kantor. Can you tell me about the experience of having a rabbi for 30 years? Who it sounded like he really had an agenda.
He did, and he was. I guess he basically was tough as nails. I mean, when he. If someone was talking in shul, and it was considered a, you know, small C conservative synagogue, so the women were able to sit with the men. But if somebody talked, he would just stop and give them the hairy eyeball. And especially when they had a certain, but before the synagogue was, they did a major restructuring in the early 60s or whatever. So all the children were kind of alongside the bima. It was a former church, actually. And he ran a tight ship, I mean, really, for that amount of time. My brother Leslie had a fairly strong relationship with Mrs. Kantor, who also taught in the Hebrew school. She only passed away a few years ago, and my brother Leslie was in the armed forces. He was a doctor and lieutenant colonel for 30 years. He's in Bedford, by the way, if you wanted to talk to him, Leslie Dubinsky. And he continued to see Mrs. Kantor in a nursing home till she passed away a few years ago, and he taped her in a long along with a few other people. He's done a few things like that, including getting the surviving members of the choir together 3 or 4 years ago for one last kind of, and he did it through Irving Schwartz in Sydney to get his cable company to send a pro in to kind of tape 6 or 7 of us singing at the bima. But as I say, Leslie continued to have a relationship with Mrs. Kantor. So essentially, for many of the kids, but particularly us, we went to that synagogue 7 days a week. We went to Cheder, you know, Hebrew school, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. We went to services on Friday evening and services on Saturday morning, and Young Judeans on Sunday. And along with that, we in the choir went to choir practice every Thursday night, basically all fall, winter, and spring, along with many of us taking part in the Jewish camp, Camp Kadima at Lewisburg, Lunenburg, rather, near Bridgewater. And so it was, you know, as I say, in context with the end of World War II, the push to maintain our Jewishness was quite strong from, you know, despite the trauma, et cetera. So it was essentially a positive experience for most of us. And you know, there were a variety of children of a variety of class structures, let's say, from doctors' children to, you know, many of the businesses in Sydney. I mean, you can still walk up the main street, Charlotte Street, and you'll see those names, you know, Jacobson's and Spinner's and Yeazer's stores. So many of them were in the clothing business and having first been in, come, many of them coming in between the two World Wars or even before the first as peddlers. And then getting into the mining communities and offering an alternative to what were essentially the company stores, which were a kind of feudal society. You know, the companies ran the towns, and so they had their own company stores. That's a whole other issue in terms of mining towns. So, I think for some aspects of his coming back to Rabbi Kenner, Leslie can tell, as I say, can tell you more. I believe he came from Austria, you know, how the issue was settled over the fact that women could sit with men in Sydney, but they couldn't in Glace Bay. I don't think they could in the pier either, in the synagogue. You know, perhaps some of the older people than me, you know, the Jack Yeazers or Shirley Chernins or whatever, can describe that perhaps better, or some of the stuff in the Beaton Institute. But it was, you know, there was no question. We were growing up in a... the fact that it was a really substantially mixed ethnic mix in Cape Breton, particularly in the industrial area, Sydney, New Waterford, Glace Bay, North Sydney, Sydney Mines. I believe I saw something recently that said, I don't know if you got down to the museum in the pier, but that there were really over 50 ethnic groups in the pier, from Italians to blacks to Ukrainians to Poles. I mean, they had their own churches, they had their own community halls. And yet, you know, when I went to Sydney Academy, which was like the main high school in Sydney, I never had any kind of problem being Jewish, and black kids went, and there was never any problem because it was so ethnically mixed that the idea that you just accepted it. It was like the United Nations, and many of them, of course, had emigrated here to escape really bad times in Europe or down south or whatever. So it was, you know, there was a large black population in the pier, particularly. And so we kind of grew up with that. And I realized as I went through college myself and performing, I remember picking up a guy who was in, we eventually played together for 10 years, and he was a waiter at one of the taverns. And then I had to wait for him to get off his shift, and I sat down with five or six guys, and I said, geez, I don't know who's Catholic here. I don't know who's Protestant here. I don't know who's a McNeil. I don't know who's a Bouchard or a Ferguson or this or that. And so in hindsight, you know, I look at it, it was a really kind of golden era for many of us, you know, the first, second generations that grew up in that milieu. It was really, which is why there's such a profound musical tradition in Cape Breton, of which you happen to be here during Celtic Colors. But I played with most of the main people, or acted as music director for, you know, the Rita McNeil and the Rankin family, etc. And just tons and tons of, the fact that there's a little over 100,000 people in all of Cape Breton, including Port Hawkesbury, and that I can name you, 10 substantial songwriters and probably 10 others, let alone fiddlers and really international musicians now, people like Natalie McMaster or Rita Wise or Raylene Rankin, who sang my song "We Rise Again" and stuff like that. So that was a whole other side of the music kind of extended into that era, and then nobody cared whether, you know, I was Jewish or whatever. You know, I was in a rock and roll band, and I could sing harmony, and I still don't read music, but I could have my keyboard player, you know, translate to the rest of the band or whatever stuff that we were doing. So it was really I did that for 12 years. Cape Breton, the Rise and Fall of Cape Breton Island, and the Cape Breton Summertime Review, and I did theater too. You know, I was taking my MA at theater in UBC in Southern Illinois, and so I had a hand. I kind of had a foot in both worlds for back and forth, kind of. You know, I did Tavia and Fiddler on the Roof and musicals, and I did Shakespeare and. So I was lucky enough to come back here. And I mean, you kind of had to be a jack of all trades to make a living here, because it's so isolated. You know, we're on the corner of North America, and it wasn't easy to, at least when I was coming through, you know, in the 60s and 70s, to tour in New England or whatever. So, you know, you really had to put out here and tour the Maritimes or whatever. The review that I worked with did tour from here to Vancouver, to British Columbia a few years, and played the Arts Center and Ottawa, etc. And we did 10 albums. We did an album every year, that kind of thing, you know, of original material. So what else can I tell you? I got off the topic of Rabbi Kanner, but he obviously was, a major influence in our lives. I mean, I don't think we would have turned out the same without him. And it wasn't really so much a spiritual growth or relationship or whatever, and yet, you know, our family's very strong in terms of supporting each other. And to this day, my sister Evie, who's in Sydney today, actually at the getting some procedure at the hospital, she and her husband conduct the services every Saturday morning at the synagogue, you know, with sometimes only 10 people, but sometimes 15 or 20 people. And they do it every Saturday morning, so the tradition continues to some degree. What else can I?
Wow. Well, that's really something. It's really a testament to the community that they would continue on, and that small numbers don't seem to phase them.
No, that's right. And, to the point where they were arranging a Jewish music night in Halifax seven or eight years ago, and they said, oh, will the Dubinsky family come up and perform? So we performed with a classical quintet, one of whom is, the member of the Nova Scotia Symphony, who's from Israel, I believe, Shimon. And, we've sung together as a family. I think I mentioned, my wife and daughter and I sang the other day here in Englishtown with a friend of ours, Ronnie McCachran, who came down from Halifax. So we still sing, and it's just, and my daughter has a great tenor in piano, and she's in science now, but... music's been a big part of our lives, and much of it emanates from us growing up here. It's just We always sang in our home. See, so that, you know, the fact that my father played guitar, my mother played piano. You know that when my father met my mother, he went to a party. She was playing St. Louis blues. You know, and that would have been, you know, pre-1940, obviously. So they were quite something. And my uncle Sam Dubinsky, who lived next door, was considered one of the best clarinet players in the country. He was a director of a 24-piece army band during World War II. So he was really a you know, first class musician. So it was the extended family too, and he was quite something. You know, I went over one day when I was 16, and I had my first guitar or something there, and I said somebody had shown me how to play in open tuning, except I couldn't figure out how to get minor chords and stuff on it. You know, so like an open D, a full open D. He played violin too as a kid and whatever. And he said, "I don't understand this. You got this in an open tuning, you know." And then he just kind of diddled with it for a second. He said, "Okay, here's your six, here's your seven, there's your." And he went right up the board, right, in a tuning that he had never played in his life, and said, "Okay, here's all your stuff." But it's kind of weird, but you know, whatever. It's interesting because I kept going on open tuning. I have a couple of Martins here and a homemade. And I happened to meet Joni Mitchell in Toronto in 67 or something like that with a friend of mine. And she invited us back into the kitchen. She was playing at this club called the Riverboat, I guess it was. And then we said, "Oh, what's that open tuning?" You know, she plays a lot in open tuning and stuff. So that was kind of a... So I still play in open tuning. But my Uncle Sam showed me, well, Sylvia did too. She said, you know, I have a small little fingers and I couldn't do bar chords decently. And my sister Sylvia said, "Well, you can, you know, you can do D, A, D, F sharp, B, you know, put your E strings in, both in D and et cetera." And, "Oh, there's an open D." And then I learned open G and, you know, a few other things. So that really helped a lot in terms of, and so that's, I started to write that way. And then I took piano when I was a kid, but I couldn't take, my sister Sylvia said, "Oh, I memorized it for the first 6 months. And then after I couldn't memorize it, I stopped going. I went to the movies on Saturday afternoon." But after I started writing tunes, I just kind of sat down at the piano and learned, you know, enough basics to write with. So,